Welcome to Inside the Hut. I'm your host, Brooke Pollock, founder of Hut Capital. Inside the Hut is a podcast that talks with leading blockchain venture capital investors to dive deep into their firm, strategy, and approach to a complex space at the forefront of innovation. You can find this and other episodes on Spotify and other podcast players, or on our website at www.hutcapital.com. The content of each episode of Inside the Hut is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any Hut Capital fund. Please note that Hut Capital and its affiliates may also maintain or be considering investments in or related to the companies, funds, assets, or strategies discussed in the podcast. For more details, including a link to our investments and related disclosures, please see www.hutcapital.com. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Inside the Hut with your host, Brooke Pollock. Really excited to have an interesting conversation this week with Evgeny Gokberg, managing partner of RE7 Capital. RE7 is not your traditional early stage venture firm that we usually chat with, so it should be a really fun conversation. Thanks for joining us, Evgeny.
Thanks, Brooke. Great to be here.
All right. So to get started, would love to just learn more about yourself, kind of introduction to you, your background, and how you got to where you are today.
I will not dazzle you with a crazy background. I spent more than 10 years in TradFi, in equity long short hedge funds, then UBS, then Deutsche Bank. So a long journey on the buy side. And then I started learning about the blockchain world, the crypto world in 2014-15. Eventually joined the blockchain startup, which was on the enterprise blockchain side of things because I was too scared of crypto itself at the time. And that was my kind of stepping stone. But then when I saw DeFi in 2019, just kind of jumped into that right away and never really looked back from that. Following a year or so of playing in DeFi, launched 3Seven Capital, and obviously we can go into that later on.
Yeah, I would actually love to get more into that. Can you just kind of describe what is 3Seven Capital? Just kind of give you a brief overview of the firm.
We wanted to do something different at the time. When I came to the point where I was ready to launch something of my own within DeFi, I was mindful that there are a lot of very smart venture funds already actively deploying in the space, and I wanted to do something different that could build a kind of a strategic moat for us. At that time, it felt like a good idea to launch a stablecoin yield fund because effectively you would be getting 30% yields with what felt to be acceptable level of risk. So it felt like a no-brainer idea, and there was obviously a gap in the market where all the degens knew the space very, very well, but not enough SUSE and TradFi people were jumping in. We started by launching a market neutral fund where the core strategy is providing liquidity into DeFi. And the hope was that through that activity, we would catapult ourselves into the heart of the ecosystem because then we become the desired customer for all DeFi protocols. We become a desired partner for venture funds because all we want to do is use their protocols. Fast forward to today, that's pretty much what played out. So providing DeFi liquidity is still the core of what we do as a firm. Fast forward to today, apart from running a DeFi yield fund, we also provide some kind of on-chain risk curation services to various DeFi protocols. We also, on the back of all this kind of knowledge and expertise, launched a liquid venture strategy. So we very much sit within the liquid side, within the crypto world, with a core focus on DeFi.
When did you start RE7? How long have you been doing this?
It went live summer of 21, so almost 3 years.
Would love to dig more into that, providing liquidity into DeFi and just better understand what that is and how it works. Maybe you can just kind of give the high level to start. What is liquidity provisioning? What is providing liquidity into that DeFi ecosystem? What role does that play within the DeFi ecosystem?
The role there is a very strategic item to zoom into. Because DeFi is no different from any traditional financial ecosystem. It just has its own nuances. So in the traditional world, construction comes to a halt when banks stop lending. In the Web2 world, where relevant, Amazon, I think, used to have a bank. I think they shut it down, where they would issue loans to their merchants, so on and so forth. And then obviously, if credit dries out, then you can trade online. And then in the case of DeFi, obviously, we don't need to go into what is DeFi, obviously. The landscape looks very different, but the logic is the same. If suddenly all liquidity providers disappear, well, guess what? Your customers, as in traders, cannot get a good price on Uniswap or something like that. The way how we think of it is, just like banks and other institutions fulfill the role of being a liquidity provider in the TradFi world, here we have unbundling. So here we have the Uniswaps of this world being the trading venues. Uniswap doesn't have any capital. It doesn't provide liquidity. It just facilitates management of the protocol that connects buyers and sellers. So then the third party can step in and be that liquidity provider. And some of these people are just retail or whales, individuals doing it for fun or as a way of making some side money. And obviously some people are doing it professionally for a living. And Re7 is one of those stakeholders. So that's kind of the strategic function that we perform in the ecosystem. When I think of this from a standpoint of a DeFi protocol, all of that macro stuff is obviously irrelevant to them. What matters is you're launching a DeFi protocol into a quite a competitive universe with still a restricted number of customers because we're not where we want to be in terms of adoption yet. You need to get into a network effect. You kind of have this chicken and egg problem on day one of your existence. How do you solve it? So obviously in an ideal world, all the traders or the borrowers come to you and use your product right away, but they can't come there if there is no liquidity. How do you get liquidity if no one has come to your platform just yet? So the way how I think of it strategically is that effectively DeFi protocols can outsource the breakage of the chicken and egg problem to a third party where we come in and we provide liquidity when it's needed or before it's needed so that when you as a trader, as a customer go to the platform, you get a good price. So it's basically providing that core strategic solution to the chicken and egg problem.
Okay, interesting. And I guess for a DeFi protocol, the more liquidity that they have, the better their spreads or prices or effectively their product and pricing for customers.
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is nuanced. DeFi just gives you a price. If Uniswap would be giving us much worse pricing than Coinbase, then not everyone would go to Uniswap. But by now in DeFi, you can get very acceptable execution on a lot of core coins. So yes, the product of DeFi in that specific case would be what slippage do you pay? What is the price that you get? If you're coming to DeFi to borrow a loan or to trade perps, the funding rate is what you get. So it's basically the cost of transacting, whether it's cost of borrowing, cost of trading or whatever. And then the more liquidity you have to a point, it's not a finite, not infinite function. There is increasing utility of that because then you get great pricing. But obviously, after a certain point, it becomes very negligible. And then more importantly, that liquidity comes at a cost. So then the real question is, up to what extent do you want to incentivize that liquidity? Because we've seen this time and time again in DeFi where people overspend and overpay for liquidity, promoting the what is called, you know, the vanity metrics of total value locked in their protocol, whilst in reality, no one is using it.
Absolutely. So you guys are providing liquidity into these DeFi protocols. How does that then turn into an investment strategy? How are you generating return? Where does that piece of it come from?
Before I answer that, obviously none of this is financial advice. That goes without saying. But the thinking is very straightforward. If you're the type of an investor who would like to earn yield on your dollars, you have the TradFi world available to you. You can put money with some quant crypto funds, and some of them are great, and they'll trade on centralized exchanges for you. Or you can tap into DeFi. And when you go into DeFi, you effectively, what do? You take your dollars, you convert them into stable coins, and then you put these stable coins into various DeFi protocols. In that case, you kind of run two risks. Risk number one is that the stable coin you're holding could blow up, theoretically. And the second risk you're holding is when you put money into DeFi protocol, it can get hacked. So the way how we think about it is we think of it as a fixed income portfolio. So when you issue a loan or when you buy a bond, on paper, it is a very binary event. You give me a loan, I either default or I don't default. But the reality is obviously much more nuanced. Maybe I default, but I repay you half of what you gave me as a loan. Or maybe I default, but actually we just delay my payment. So on and so forth. So when you construct a portfolio of these risks, you start to standardize them and you find certain patterns. And that's why in the real world, we have credit risk and credit ratings to manage the credit risk. So here our approaches and kind of the value proposition is very straightforward that we go and build a portfolio of these credit risks where we get various stable coins and exposure to various DeFi protocols. In our specific way, we manage that risk. And then as an investor, you get yield on your stable coins because we deploy that liquidity into DeFi. We get paid for providing that liquidity in some shape or form. Maybe we put this money into, I know, Uniswap, and then people come and they trade, and then we collect trading fees. Or maybe we're doing some arbitrage, or maybe we're doing some special situations, or. But basically, we act as an on-chain market maker or an on-chain lender. We get paid for that when people use our capital.
The yield that exists, so let's say you're providing capital on an exchange or let's say a lending pool, something like that. How much of that typically is the yield you would earn from any loan? There's an interest rate that one pays and that would go to you versus maybe earning tokens native to the protocol and potential yield that comes from that. Does one tend to be greater than the other? Like, how do you think about how you earn yield from that perspective?
That's very important to highlight indeed, because the range could be very vast. So sometimes it's 50-50. So let's say we're earning 20%, and then half can come from trading fees that we earn and half comes from some incentives, whatever that might be. In some cases, it's 0 and 100 or 100 and a 0. It can vary a lot. And then a big part of what we have to do is we have to take a view on how reliable that future yield expectation is, because maybe we're earning yield in some random tokens and then these tokens are useless and then tomorrow they're going to go to 0. Well, then guess what? We didn't actually earn any yield. And obviously that happens probably as often as you would expect. So then part of the job is positioning portfolio in such a way that you actually have a reliable source of yield and you don't have to jump back and forth. And that's probably where we're different from, let's say, those who go into very young and new and aggressive protocols, because we probably take a slightly more conservative view.
Backing up a sec before we continue diving into the world of liquidity provisioning, how big is the team? How big is the firm? I would imagine you structure a team differently for what you guys do than, let's say, a traditional venture firm. So can you kind of speak to that as well?
There are about 10 of us. We're structured in a very, very different way. So we have a team that is full responsibility for DeFi liquidity and yield strategies. We have a team that has sole responsibility for running our liquid token, kind of liquid venture strategy. And then we have a team of engineers that supports all of that with building trading bots, with building data tooling and data analytics, which is especially very important for our liquid venture strategy, where using all the information we're getting from the blockchain and all the intelligence, we make decisions, investment decisions into kind of small cap tokens, and having real-time data is obviously very important.
Okay. Yeah, I'd imagine there's quite a lot of synergy between those two strategies and teams.
And that's exactly why we wanted to build a firm this way, because it's very hard to create these synergies unless you're kind of full-time on-chain operator.
Digging in more and maybe to the diligence side of things, I know you guys see dozens of opportunities every week. How do you screen high level what's interesting to dig in further? And then once you're kind of deeper in diligence, how do you decide what's interesting for you guys? What does a good deal look like from your perspective?
So at the core of all of that is our mission statement when it comes to DeFi yield. When we talk to our investors, for example, we always tell them that we don't see our job as generating the highest rate of return possible with that specific strategy, but rather giving people the most optimal risk-adjusted rate of return. And this is very different to our liquid venture strategy, where we tell investors very explicitly that we'll take the maximum amount of risk we can, and we're going for absolute returns. Because when you're chasing a 20x performance on a liquid token, I think you can take quite a bit of risk. If your mission is to make 20, 30% a year, you should probably be a little bit more careful. That's at the core of that. So then what we had to do is we had to design our own smart contract risk assessment framework, where every DeFi protocol we talk to, we analyze across a variety of different points, we come out with a kind of with a risk rating. It's like AAA, BBB, CCC. That becomes step one. Step two is looking at the expected rate of return. And then we get a ratio, so to speak. And then we compare that ratio to what we have in our portfolio, because our portfolio at any point in time is deployed across at least 20, 30 DeFi protocols. So then if we're adding something new, we have to pool capital from elsewhere. And then it has to make sense on a risk-adjusted basis. So then when a new deal comes in, and you're absolutely right, we're seeing dozens of them a week, which far exceeds our capacity to actually even process them, because there are just too many DeFi protocols that are being launched, which is also probably a signal on its own. Step one is understanding what is the expected level of yield slash return and how reliable is it. So if it's just a new early protocol which comes and says that they're going to give us some of their tokens, which will have a 12-month lockup, then it's very hard for us to proceed with that because we have to take a discretionary view on the expected valuation of these tokens. And unless it's something that's a no-brainer, and there are very few of those, then it becomes very hard to do such a deal. So then if the expected rate of return is reasonable, then we'll go to work. Then we start doing very deep security reviews and other types of risk assessments. And then the process, if it all makes sense, then we'll just shift capital within our portfolio.
You're mentioning kind of these risk scores. I know you guys have a database, you're tracking, I don't know the exact number, it's somewhere north of 100 protocols through that. Is that an automated risk score based on on-chain data, or is it more manual given kind of technical assessment and such?
It's a bit of both. When it comes to monitoring, we have real-time monitoring of various events and ratios and prices and data, basically, which then spins up alerts and other risk management mitigation tools. But when it comes to the actual assessment, it still has to be a very manual process because you need to speak to the team, ask them a lot of questions, you know, form a view on a lot of different things, go through audit reports, do kind of a mini audit yourself, look at many, many other things until ChatGPT becomes ChatGPT, whatever, 200, whatever, 24. It's going to be quite manual because you do need that expertise. And one of the reasons why we have it is because we've been around for a while and we've seen a lot of things go wrong. And through that, we've accumulated a library of risks and we're referencing them when we do our research.
Yeah, you're alluding to it in your answer there, but two of the risks that exist are technical risk. The code just is not good. And then two is the protocol just isn't structured in a proper way. So it's, I guess, poorly established in that sense. You guys are going in and actually like reviewing code, or how do you mitigate those potential risks for any protocol?
Yeah, we have to review code. That's the only way. Some of our analysts on our team, they may not know how to read a balance sheet or a financial statement, but they know how to read smart contracts, which is far more important for us when it comes to this specific type of activity.
The right skill set for crypto. So
exactly.
You guys are deploying stable coins. You may deploy other assets as well, but you do deploy stable coins. There are a number of different stable coins out there. What stable coins are you comfortable working with? How do you decide which ones you are comfortable working with and think through that side of the strategy?
That's a great question. And one of the challenges, I think, for our industry as a whole is that the word stablecoin is actually a bit misleading. These are simply wrappers for financial products. So when you put money into USDC or USDT, what happens in reality is that you give your dollars to these two companies, and then they issue this kind of IOU, which they don't give you any interest on. And then that note is kind of a promise that they'll give you your dollars back when you come and take it out. So these are, you know, credit instruments, effectively. Then when you look at something like USD or the whole Luna story, that's a financial engineering wrapper. When you look at something like Athena, it's a structured product wrapped in a stablecoin wrapper. It's very important to go inside that wrapper and understand how the mechanism works. And actually, once you spend some time looking at it and thinking about it, they're usually very straightforward. There are kind of three categories that we see there. So number one is the Circles and the Tethers of this world. So a centralized company is holding your dollars and you hope that they're doing everything the right way and they're not going to defraud you. That's number one. With them, it's not always easy to get transparency. So you have to trust the system, whether the system is the government of the United States or whatever, that they'll enforce the good behavior. The second category is stable coins backed by crypto assets issued directly on the blockchain. So for example, DAI or Liquidity and many, many others. So a bunch of people put ETH BTC into effectively a lending protocol, and then a stable coin is issued on the back of that. So that's what in TradFi we would call a Lombard loan, not different from a mortgage. So you put in an asset, you put in 100, you borrow 70-ish. And then all you need to do is have real-time monitoring to make sure that the margin call mechanism works. And as long as it does, you're fully solvent. If it doesn't work, then you can potentially face a loss. So once you track things, it's pretty straightforward. And then the third section would be structured products. So something like Athena, where it's a financial strategy that is being offered to DeFi via a stablecoin wrapper. So then we analyze all of this. They all have their own different risks and nuances. But the great thing is that they're relatively straightforward to monitor in terms of risk and deviation from the peg. And then you can make your decisions pretty quickly. So we've dealt with dozens of stablecoins. We've thankfully have never had a single cent in Anchor, which has been a very nice experience. But we've seen ups and downs. We've seen various stablecoins work and not work, collapse, not collapse. You can classify them and treat them as a portfolio of assets, and then it becomes a very straightforward job.
For a given protocol, do you find that certain stablecoins offer better yield than others? And is that consistent, or is it just dependent on the supply demand of capital for each specific protocol?
There are kind of three layers to the yield. Some of the yield is a function of the chain where you operate. Some yield is a function of the DeFi protocol and then of an asset itself. So it could very well happen that, let's say Uniswap, you can have, I know, some asset A on Uniswap or asset A and B because it's a pair on Ethereum that you get no yield because no one is trading them and there are no rewards. And then you go to some L2 and actually that chain itself is giving you a lot of rewards for being there. And then you're taking the same asset, the same protocol, but you're getting a much higher rate of return because it's a different chain. Why do you need to offer higher yield to people? You need to offer it to make sure people come to you, whether you are a stablecoin or what have you. So then obviously, if you are a very well-established dominant player, you don't really need to offer any rewards. People will come and use you anyway. But you do offer rewards either if people aren't coming to you as much as you would like them to, which could be maybe you're just younger and you're fighting for your spot under the sun, or maybe you're lower quality and people are afraid of the risks. So what we're seeing in DeFi is risk and return aren't always correlated. There are places which give you very high yield because at least we believe for them to be extremely risky. And there are other places where you can get exactly the same yield, but what we believe to be a much lower level of risk. So the market feels pretty inefficient to us in that regard. So there is no clear pattern to answer your question.
Speaking of different chains, can Re7 provide liquidity on any blockchain? Are there certain ones that you're able to operate on? Curious which blockchains you work with and how you think about that as well.
In terms of, you know, our knowledge and experience, we can do really any blockchain. But in terms of the day-to-day reality, we're restricted by the limitations of a custodial setup. Being a fund, we have some very strict operational policies and we don't do any self-custody. It's all in custodial solutions, and therefore we're restricted by the virtue of custodians not supporting every single chain, which could be a blessing in disguise because then that indirectly protects you from going into the far, far corners of the universe. But we have been deploying liquidity on dozens of chains, predominantly VM, because obviously the most established ones, but also when you think of the usual suspects on, you know, design in Rust language or Move language, we have experience with those as well. But EVM has been the center of what we've been doing so far.
If I'm a blockchain foundation, I could see a situation where I'm thinking, hey, I'd like to bring more liquidity into our ecosystem. We probably shouldn't do this directly. We should go work with someone like Re7 to do that because they're independent. They know what they're doing. Do you ever have blockchain foundations approach you guys to do things like that?
Yeah, that happens pretty frequently because what people realize now that we've been into DeFi for quite a few years, is that liquidity incentives alone are not sufficient to bootstrap an ecosystem. There are too many well-funded blockchains with capital to kind of source their users. So then instead, what you have to do as a foundation is to design your whole DeFi roadmap and your whole DeFi go-to-market strategy, because just having a DEX and a lending protocol and a few incentives is not going to do the job. So then, yes, people do reach out to us because firstly want to support their own blockchains with liquidity, but more importantly, they realize that they do need some support and some partnerships and guidance on what's their business card. Why do I, as a DeFi user, go to chain A versus chain B? And in most cases, it's very hard to answer the question. So therefore, building a kind of a multi-layer DeFi ecosystem where at first you have the basic needs covered, like the public goods infrastructure, and then on top of that, building something differentiated, that obviously takes a lot of work. And these are kind of multi-year engagements that we have with various foundations.
So you guys do have active relationships with certain foundations of that nature?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm curious about the competitive dynamics. We don't see a lot of funds out there doing this. Where does the capital typically come from DeFi protocols? Is it very competitive? Are they all begging you guys for capital? Can you kind of speak to the competitive dynamics around doing this?
It really depends on the specific situation with the protocol. So when we think of something like EigenLayer and different LRT protocols around it, I mean, they've sourced, and well, both LRTs and LRT5, the Renzos, the Pendles, the Gearboxes of this world, the Morphos of this world, they've sourced an insane amount of capital in billions and billions and billions on the promise of future airdrops, effectively. And that's fine. That's DeFi. That's basically at the core of why we're all here. But here what you have is effectively you have a very meaningful project, which is EigenLayer, which indicated directly or indirectly that there's going to be a big bonus if you provide liquidity early. And that was signaled to the world. And then everyone came looking. It's like lifting a torch in the middle of the night. People come there because they have expectation this could be something very, very meaningful. Then I'm sure a lot of venture funds are parking their ETH there as well. You obviously have liquid funds, whether they're DeFi or CeFi, whatever. You have whales, individuals, foundations, protocols. Everyone is just going, parking their capital there. But that's obviously quite rare. And actually, the EigenLayer is a great example because imagine you're a DeFi protocol and you need ETH for some reason instead of stablecoins. Now you have to come to, I know, 37 and say, well, instead of putting your ETH with, I know, EigenLayer or Renzo, put it with us. And like, well, we have a very high opportunity of cost of capital. So then why would we do it with you? Because maybe we're taking higher risk. And then it's very hard for those types of protocols to compete. It's very, very binary. I haven't yet seen situations where a DeFi protocol needed liquidity and it was such a competitive deal that we were priced out or something didn't happen. It's very different dynamics to a venture fund because usually liquidity needs are broader than, you know, size of a venture fundraise. So therefore, DeFi protocols, and again, you know, Ethene is a great example. They kind of offer, well, firstly, that structure product is giving pretty high yield or has been giving so far. And then you have this promise of an airdrop, which did materialize. So people just flock to that. If a protocol is big and famous and has a lot of supporters, they go and play these games with points, with airdrops. And in the background, they work with people like us directly, but also they just bring a lot of third-party capital. And then they scale pretty quickly. When it comes to projects that are either earlier in their journey or they don't have such loud support, then usually they're practically reaching out to people like ourselves, as well as obviously providing incentives to fill in the liquidity needs that they have.
Let's say you're an upstart DeFi protocol. Is there kind of a known group of folks like yourselves who do this type of stuff that they reach out to? Or is it a lot also just based on personal relationships and reaching out to whales or funds or a bit more ad hoc?
It's a bit of everything. Eventually, people like ourselves, well, Re7 and people like Re7, they have some reputation in the space, and then eventually someone reaches out to you. So you are a DeFi protocol, you talk to your VC, and your VC says, well, you should speak to Re7 and these five or more people. So through that, you get to talk to people who do this for a living, as well as whales and what have you. And then through that, it gradually grows through the network. And then indirectly, there are other ways of sourcing that. If you get integrated in the main kind of DeFi dashboards, then someone will pick up the fact that your yield is great. But when you can't or don't want to offer crazy incentives or crazy level of return, then it becomes harder because then you need to go and structure deals with people who can commit.
A DeFi protocol is by definition permissionless. So anyone theoretically can go in and provide capital into one of these pools. Are you typically negotiating one-on-one with the team and saying, hey, we'll put in X dollars and here's kind of the deal that we're going to have, and you negotiate something of that nature? Or is it just you do your diligence and you either deploy or don't deploy, but the team, they don't necessarily need to know because you're just doing it like anyone could theoretically?
When it comes to deploying capital, we always make an effort to get to know the team because that's part of our risk assessment. But when it comes to the actual economics, the short answer is it depends. We may choose to deploy some capital into Uniswap, and then no one is going to talk to us and we don't need to talk to anyone, versus us deploying capital into something that's very early and very young. It's a function of many different pieces, but realistically, it's a function of supply-demand of liquidity for that specific protocol. Again, using Uniswap as an example, there is enough market supply of liquidity into Uniswap, and they're very well established. So therefore, unless we're bringing $1 trillion, then it doesn't make sense for us to go and negotiate with the team. If it's a younger protocol where, you know, we're taking serious risks, then obviously we'll have to protect our investors and negotiate special terms.
Is your strategy limited to the world of DeFi, or are there other categories of crypto where you can deploy capital like this and earn a yield and where you guys are active?
We do use CeFi a little bit, because for example, let's say we're running some bots that arbitrage some on-chain and off-chain stuff, and you do need to have some CeFi presence as well. That's probably the core thing. When it comes to RWAs, we've been very cautious because some RWAs are very easy, like treasuries. But when it comes to some very funky off-chain lending, we're being very, very careful because, again, coming from TradFi, doing credit analysis on some company in emerging markets who is borrowing from you, that's a very different job from looking at smart contracts. If our investors want to have that exposure, they'll just go to a credit fund in TradFi instead of using us. So we just choose to specialize within DeFi, because there is more than enough work to be done, whilst other people can take the other niche.
So you're based in the UK. If you're sitting in the US, let's say you personally deploy capital into a DeFi pool, you get some airdrop. A lot of times, or maybe typically, US residents might be excluded from participating in that type of activity. So can something like this be done institutionally from the US, or does it have to basically be offshore?
My understanding is that most projects geoblock the States, or at least a lot of them, and therefore it becomes very hard to do it from the States, which is one of the many reasons why we don't do it out of the States. It's basically harder because then, you know, as a fund, I would assume you have to choose, okay, do I use VPNs and try to circumvent this, but maybe it's not great, maybe it's not very safe. I'm not aware of too many people who are doing it kind of institutionally from out of the US, but maybe they're just keeping a low profile.
Say within crypto in general, you have these historical market cycles that we're all aware of. Do you see that within the yield side as well? How is the current market right now for generating yield? Does it tend to be pro-cyclical, counter-cyclical? I'm curious about the current market dynamics right now that you're seeing.
The yields are very pro-cyclical. The capital, if you're market neutral, is obviously not cyclical at all, but the level of yield is, because your yield is a function of either market activity, and the more people trade on chain, the more fees you generate, or it's the function of the value of the tokens you're earning as rewards. In 21, we've seen, you know, 30-40% yields. Then in 22, we have seen yields go from 20 in the beginning of the year to below 10 at the end of the year. Last year, the yields were, I remember in the summer, they were below 10%, and then they gradually recovered, and current yields are 30% plus. So yeah, it's a very cyclical space in terms of yields. And paradoxically, that's why it's quite hard for DeFi protocols to get liquidity in the bull market, because there are so many other places offering very high yields, it becomes hard to compete with that. Whilst a year ago, it was much easier. Well, there was much less capital available, but it was much easier because if your base DeFi yield is whatever, 9%, and someone is offering you a deal with 19, you obviously take it. Right now, if the market is giving you 30% plus in very safe names, then you don't want to do anything below 50. It's pretty hard for DeFi protocol to compete with that.
I saw that Maker increased their DSR, I think the daily savings rate recently. Maybe they're in process of doing it. I'm not sure if it's been technically completed at this point. So I was just curious, it seemed like a pretty material shift. Has that been having an impact on the broader market in terms of providing liquidity, or is it rather isolated?
Indirectly, obviously, if you're a liquidity provider in DeFi, and let's say you only do DeFi, you'll say, well, if I can get 15% on Maker, then why would I get 14% anywhere else? And then you would say, well, I'm getting my 20% in some random place. I feel safer making 15 on Maker. It hasn't had the same level of impact as treasury rates, you know, in the States, or the base rate going up or down. But I think it's all part of the same trend. So the rates and the yields are much higher, and Maker is readjusting, and the market is readjusting alongside it. If tomorrow Maker lowers their rate, I don't think the broader market will necessarily notice, but it's certainly an indicator.
So I guess last question, kind of specific to liquidity provisioning. So you guys have your own vehicles, but you also started as a curator of vaults on Morpho, which is a decentralized lending protocol for folks who aren't familiar, similar conceptually to Compound or Aave, although I know it works a bit different. Can you just kind of explain what does that mean and how that works?
We have launched V7 Labs, which is a standalone division, so to speak. There's a very interesting trend that's happening right now. So you have Morpho and other generation 2.0 lending protocols, and they're experimenting with a new model where they, just like Uniswap in a way, unbundle running of the protocol itself and outsourcing risk decisions or risk management to third parties. So let's say, taking Morpho as an example, it's a DeFi protocol which grew very, very rapidly, amazing team. They have established a panel of what they call risk curators, where independent risk curators run individual vaults. And this way, what you can do is you can have people who specialize in specific fields of DeFi or RWAs potentially, and then these people go and run lending markets. So we've seen over the years that lending business in DeFi is pretty difficult from a security standpoint. Price manipulation and other risks are quite prevalent. The idea is, if you run isolated markets, all of them managed by specific people who specialize in a very specific field, you can have better risk management. We've started working with various DeFi protocols, Morpho being the first of them, where we kind of outsource and lend our DeFi experience and basically help curate various markets when it comes to lending protocols.
When you say curating, so you're deciding what asset is borrowed, what collateral ratios look like, that kind of stuff? What are you actually deciding?
So it's more of a guidance to the DAO in a sense. So a risk curator would propose listing of, let's say, specific assets. Then the DAO would decide if they want to go ahead or not. Obviously, they lean in and they listen to what is being proposed, but ultimately DAO decides. And then once the DAO decides, what's very important is actually managing liquidity within that, managing various lending parameters. And that's where the risk curator needs to propose a specific algorithm as to how it works, and then basically enforce it. So then when you go into a lending vault, you know upfront how it's being managed, what the parameters are. You as a lender decide whether you're happy with those parameters. And then the job of a risk curator is simply to run those parameters in the background.
Okay, that's really cool. We've spent most of the time today talking about the liquidity provisioning side of things and kind of the crypto yield strategy, just given it's very fascinating and interesting category. But that's not all that you guys do, as you alluded to in the initial introduction. You guys also run a long-only token strategy. Can you explain what that is and the synergies between that and the crypto yield side? I'm curious where you see the benefits there as well.
We're seeing that there is an interesting space right now where there is a lot of competition between venture funds when it comes to getting into top deals. We see competition amongst traders getting into the most famous tokens. As our universe grows, there are more and more crypto projects that have been around for a while. They have some traction, some better than others. But in this market where attention is king and people don't look at something for more than 5 seconds, there is a whole niche of mispriced businesses. You may have good crypto founders, a good team, a good project, a good business, but for some reason, and it has a liquid token, but it's not being priced accordingly. So then what we do is we run a concentrated portfolio of small cap, mid cap tokens. We're using our DeFi knowledge, experience, access to information, access to people. We make these small mid cap investments where the objective is to not hold any names that are famous or well known and focus on very materially outperforming ETH. And that's the intention, not financial advice. But the logic is you can find a lot of mispriced mid-cap assets using differentiated knowledge, expertise, and access, potentially outperform the market quite materially.
Okay. And do you guys solely operate with DeFi sector assets, or do you go broader beyond that?
We go broader because for us, DeFi behavior, it spans to NFT behavior, social behavior, and obviously there's a lot of infrastructure that enables all of that. The way how we think of it is we focus on crypto native use cases, and there is a lot that we can do within that. And whenever we do something, it's usually on the back of a very specific thesis and well thought out investigation into the core business and into the team itself.
So you've been running RE7, what I guess for 3 years now, give or take. What's been like the biggest lesson running the firm and the strategy? If you could go back in time and give yourself some advice or tell yourself one thing when you're getting going, what would you tell yourself?
The more I continue on this entrepreneurial and founder journey, the more it becomes clear to me that the only limitation that any business has is the internal blockers of its leaders, meaning that most issues and risks and challenges that are out there, most of them are fully manageable if you're running a sound business model, of course. And my advice to myself would be to probably worry less and have faith that things will sort itself out. It's not always easy to do that when you launch shortly before the bear market starts. But if you just have confidence in your team and your approach, then probably worrying less is valuable advice.
Worrying less is a good piece of advice for everybody. So if crypto didn't exist, you couldn't work in finance, what would you do for a living?
I would be very sad.
So we don't want to know.
I know. I would be traveling the world and trying to turn that into a living of sorts.
I like it. Sounds like good living if you can figure it out.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Awesome. So, you know, if people want to find out more about yourself and RE7, where can they find you guys online?
Twitter, our website is re7.capital, Twitter re7 capital. Yeah, ping us. Always happy to meet fellow crypto people, DeFi people, and look for partners.
Awesome. Well, this is a really fun conversation. Thanks so much for joining us, Evgeny. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside the Hut with your host, Brooke Pollock. You can find this and other episodes on any podcast player or at our website, www.hutcapital.com.